This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. A few weeks back, I had the good fortune to be invited to speak at the AFSCIA DHS conference, and I spoke at the small business portion. And it was number one, a lot of fun. I had not spoken at an AFSCIA event before, and I had an audience of probably 250 or so people. The room was pretty packed, which I always like. But I also had the opportunity that day to meet the president and CEO of AFSCIA, Kent Schneider, and he is my guest today. Kent, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in, because coming down to D.C. in the middle of the afternoon is not usually my idea of a good time. But thank you. Let's start off with a little bit of your background, possibly pre-AFSCIA, and then when you got the nod for your...
Sure, happy to. I've been basically in the command and control, communications, information technology business for 44 years now. I started with 26 years in the Army Signal Corps, where I worked on mostly command and control, information technology kinds of things. Retired from the Army in 1994, went to work for industry, started out with a company called PRC that no longer exists.
Well, part of Northrop, actually, but yeah.
Well, and in fact, yeah. I stayed with the company. It's just the parents changed. So
yeah.
PRC was owned by Black & Decker at the time that I went to work for them. It was sold by Black & Decker to Litton. Litton was later acquired by Northrop Grumman. So in 2007, when I left Northrop Grumman, having been the president of the defense group, which ran the domestic defense business for the IT sector and the international business for the IT sector, then I moved over to AFSCIA International, and I've been the president CEO of AFSCIA now for 6.5 years, but a member of AFSCIA for 44 years.
I was going to say you'd probably been kind of involved.
Yeah, I actually got involved in AFSCIA right after I was commissioned as a second lieutenant. I went through my first pay line as a second lieutenant. These were the days when we got paid in cash, and all the creditors sat along the side of the table. And so you started with whatever they were going to pay you at one end of the table, and when you got to the other end, whatever you had left was what you had for the month. And about halfway down the table was the representative from AFSCIA, and he said, "Lieutenant, are you a member of AFSCIA?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, that'll be $15." So there was no discussion about the value proposition. It was just a given in those days that if you were a second lieutenant in the Signal Corps, you were a member of AFSCIA, and I've been a member ever since.
Probably no regrets, too. Back to PRC very briefly. PRC won the second GWAC ever awarded in the Super Mini contract, and Jim Leto's head on that, Mike Berman, and his marketing guy, Mark Moyt, brought me in to consult on the marketing side of that contract. So I'm very familiar with PRC, and that was a very fun contract to play with.
Yeah, actually, it was a great way to start my industry career. As you mentioned, Jim Leto was the chairman of the board at that time. Bill Hoover, now at American Systems, mm-hmm. Was the president of PRC at the time. And my immediate boss was Austin Yerkes, who you probably know.
Yeah.
So Austin was the head of marketing, but he was the number two guy in management. I was a direct report to him. Of course, he later moved to CSC and did marketing, and then ran the defense unit there later. But it was a great start because Austin was a great mentor. Bill Hoover is just a great
Bill was
manager
on the show a couple months ago. Great guy.
And the thing is, I learned. an important lesson, I think, that I try to pass on to as many people that are transitioning from government as I possibly can. You know, you're leaving government and they ask you, so what do you want to do? And most, particularly military, will say, well, I want to run something, right? Because your whole military career, you're always taught command is better than everything else. And I tell people, not so fast, you know, that there's too much that you don't know, and worse yet, you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. And you can get in real trouble running a P&L right away. So Austin was smart enough to put me in staff roles for the first 2 years, 1 year at corporate as the director of C4I, where I was looking across the company in that space, looking at how the company could better engage that market. And then I moved down to the Defense Systems Division, where I was the number two guy there, but focused mostly on business development and incubational programs. And then after 2 years, I started with a small business. And then 4 years later, I was the president of the Defense Systems Division. But by that time, I was ready to run the division because I really understood how the company worked. And So I've seen some really smart people tank fairly fast because they put them directly into a P&L. They don't know enough to do it, and they don't even realize necessarily that they're in trouble until they're really in trouble, and then it's too late.
It is, and it's a market that is perpetually evolving. There are hundreds of facets that any upper-level manager needs to know, particularly a CEO. And if you don't know them, you have to know the people that do, and you have to have immediate access to those people. But you've got to know where those voids are in your education.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you know, a lot of people come out of government and they say, well, I've run big budgets. But what they don't understand and is probably one of the most critical parts of managing in industry is understanding the indirect side of the budget and how to set rates and all of those kinds of things. And the other part that they don't know is the whole business development part. You know, so when you're in government, you see something that needs to be done, you just do it.
Yeah.
If you're in industry, you see something you want to be part of, you got to find somebody that's willing to sponsor that on the government side and pay you to do it.
Yep.
And that's a new thing for people coming out of government.
Totally different animal. Let's talk a little bit about the scope of AFSEA and the mission. And I don't think we can talk about everything AFSEA does, but let's give it a 25,000 foot view.
Sure. So AFSEA was created in 1946 in the wake of World War II. To fill what was perceived to be a void in communication between government and industry in the communications arena and electronics. Of course, IT, as we know it today, information technology, was not a factor yet at that point. The initial focus was on Army, but if you remember your history, it was the next year, 1947, that the Department of Defense was created, and at that point, AFSEA very quickly expanded to embrace all of defense. It then wasn't until 1981 that we expanded again to embrace intelligence. And then, of course, not until the 2000s that we expanded again to embrace homeland security. But basically, our space today is C4ISR, information technology, and cybersecurity across defense, intelligence, and homeland security. We are now a truly international organization. About 30% of our membership is outside the United States. While we've been around since 1967, we have supported NATO in Europe since over the last 55 years. And we've been in the Pacific for about the last 45 years. So right now, we have 137 chapters globally. 34 of those are in Europe. We have about a dozen chapters in the Pacific, ranging from Australia to Japan to Korea to Taiwan to Guam to Okinawa. And we have one chapter in South America, in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. Some years ago, the idea was to establish a beachhead down there and then expand across South America. I think that was kind of a ill-fated adventure because they didn't realize that the South American countries don't like each other very much. And so having a presence in one country turned out not to be a huge advantage in another country. But so we operate today in a variety of countries. We have at least one chapter in every NATO member nation, so we're very strong in NATO. Of course, our largest presence is in the United States. So anywhere, basically, that there is a significant concentration of defense, intelligence, or homeland security, you're likely to find an AFCEA chapter.
Yeah, you can shake a stick in Maryland, find a few. So,
well, in the greater, we have a third of our membership in depending on how you define the greater Washington area, basically from Aberdeen and in Maryland, where the Army Communication Electronics Command is, down to Central Maryland. The Central Maryland chapter is right outside Fort Meade, so it supports NSA, the U.S. Cyber Command, now DISA, which yep. moved out of Northern Virginia, the component cyber commands, and we have a Bethesda chapter that supports the civil part of the federal government with a focus on homeland security and health IT. We have a chapter in Frederick, Maryland, which kind of focuses on energy. We have a chapter in Washington, D.C. that focuses at the policy level. Northern Virginia, our largest chapter, focuses more at the operational level. We have a chapter at Fort Belvoir that focuses on the Army, and another one at Quantico that focuses on the Marine Corps. So
we've
pretty much saturated the greater Washington area with a variety of chapters, and then pretty much everywhere else across the United States where there are significant concentrations of folks.
Okay. We're going to take our first break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is Ken Schneider of AFCEA. You can find a lot of information at AFCEA.org, and I suggest that you do so back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today is Ken Schneider. He is the president and CEO of AFCEA. And I want to thank my friend Max Kakis for helping me get Kent down here. It's been a long time, bud. So we'll not be that long again. Let's talk about the Educational Foundation, and after that, perhaps the broad reach of your events. And we can talk about a different side of communication.
Sure. So I mentioned earlier that the original mission of AFCEA was to create an environment for an ethical dialogue among government, industry, and academia around C4ISR, IT, and cybersecurity. We continue to have that mission today, but it wasn't very long into the process, maybe 20 years after we were created, that they came to the realization that workforce development was a very important part of the process, that we needed enough skilled technical people to support these missions. So the AFCEA Educational Foundation was created to do that. The AFCEA Educational Foundation is a 501c3 charitable organization, so we can accept donations and sponsorships. Its mission is to support STEM education, and we do that in two ways. Across AFCEA, we contribute about $2.5 million per year in scholarships and grants in the STEM space. The grants, for the most part, are directed at the middle school and high school level to enable STEM teachers to enhance their programs and hopefully motivate students to pursue technical careers. The scholarships then are directed at the undergraduate and graduate level in STEM specialties. We also operate within the Educational Foundation a professional development center designed to provide training and education for people in the specialties that we operate and within the communities that we operate. We don't try to compete with either educational organizations or training companies. What we try to do is fill niches that are either not economically feasible for other kinds of organizations or that the government eventually plans to cover but can't ramp up fast enough. And so a lot of times we can be more agile than the government in terms of getting that training in place to start. Now we are transitioning our professional development center from brick and mortar training to distance learning because travel budgets are tight. Neither industry nor government can afford to send people off for a week to attend a course. They want them to be able to learn at their own pace. So we've now created what we call an educational hub. We are creating alliances with best of breed colleges and universities around the world that specialize in the areas that that we're interested in. What we try to do through that is to bring to all of our members, and we have approximately 1,800 corporate members, about 82% of which are small business and therefore have limited budgets for training. So
what percentage are small?
82%.
Wow, that's what I thought you said.
Yeah, so we try to create situations where small business, by working through the scale of AFCEA, can get the same kind of cost leverage that large companies can get for training and education. So when I was at Northrop Grumman, if we wanted to put together a course, we could work with a university. They would come on our campus, you know, present to our group at a very reasonable price. A small business can't do that. So whether we're talking about physical training or distance training, we try to use our scale to get the prices down to something close to what a large business would do for, and primarily for our small businesses, although sometimes our large businesses will leverage those. So I'll give you one example. We're working with Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, which operates the Software Engineering Institute, which is a DOD-sponsored FFRDC, a federally funded R&D center. And one of the things they operate is the National CERT, the Computer Emergency Response Team. And that CERT, working with the rest of the Carnegie Mellon faculty, have put together a series of 36 online courses, which are now provided at no cost to anybody in the government because they bought an enterprise license. And AFCEA is now the only channel outside the government for that training. We can provide that to industry, we can provide it to foreign government or wherever it needs to go. And the deal we've made with Carnegie Mellon is we can provide a one-year subscription to all 36 courses for the price of one course, which is $1,500. So you can get access to everything you need to get cybersecurity certification for $1,500, which is just unheard of.
So phenomenal.
So those are the kinds of, I mean, I just use that as an example, but those are the kinds of things that we try to package to make the training and education affordable, particularly to small business.
Okay. Well, you were obviously at the event where I spoke.
Sure.
That was the, is that an annual DHS event? How many, my question, I guess, is, how many of those types of events does AFCEA do? Because that seemed to be pretty well attended.
So out of the headquarters, we run about 30 events per year across all the market spaces. So some are defense, some are intelligence, some homeland security. They vary in size from, you know, 300 to 500 probably on the low end to 10,000 plus, you know, on the high end.
So mine was a smaller one.
Yeah, well, Homeland Security is obviously a growing market, so it's probably not as well attended as many of the defense events, although it's growing year over year, and we're expanding the scope of it every year. In addition to the 30 events that we run out of the headquarters, our office in Brussels, which serves NATO, oversees another six or so events. And then our chapters around the world run about 130 events a year. So collectively around the world, we're running about 165 major events each year. That's not counting, you know, monthly chapter luncheons and things right. like that, which for our large chapters can be sizable. I mean, the Northern Virginia chapter, which has a 6,000 members, can have 800 people for a monthly luncheon. So, you know, it's not, we don't consider that a major event, but it's still a pretty significant gathering for networking and information sharing purposes.
Exactly. And AFSEA Central Maryland meets over in Greenbelt.
Exactly.
And they have 300 to 500 every month they have the lunch. So,
right, exactly.
And again, the networking is superb. Let's talk a little bit on the communication side here to back up to this. That networking capability in my seminars, particularly government marketing best practices, I talk about, you know, how events are still a major part of our infrastructure, but the attendance is down. You reference that. It's harder for feds to get out, probably just as difficult, if not more so, for military people to get out, travel restrictions, even just getting out of the office. But the first thing I tell people to look at when they're looking at a venue to try to get to out of the house is out of the shop is what the pedigree of the producer is. And AFSEA has a pedigree that probably is not rivaled, number one, for the quality of the events, but, you know, also how long you've been doing them.
So. Well, absolutely. One of the things you have to do when you're putting on an event or any kind of forum that aims to share information and provide networking is to examine the value proposition from the standpoint of all the stakeholders. So we serve government, we serve industry, we serve academia. Government is not homogeneous with regard to the value proposition. Missions vary from one kind of organization to another. Industry is similarly not homogeneous. There are large businesses, medium-sized businesses, small businesses. They have different needs with regard to networking and information sharing. They're also in different industries, particularly since we've gotten into homeland security. We've gotten more involved with the critical infrastructure industries, financial services, energy, transportation, and so on. They have different kinds of requirements. So I think one of the things that distinguishes AFSEA from many other organizations is we take very seriously the analysis of that value proposition. We also engage very heavily in advance of a program or an event with government, with industry, with academia to understand what the requirements are, what it is that they need out of that thing. And we also try to make it very interactive. We do not want a series of speakers and panelists to get up and provide lectures. In fact, I often, when I'm introducing an event, tell the audience that, you know, we're delighted they're there. Our job is to provide a dialogue, and the dialogue can't exist unless you have two-way communication. And therefore, while we're happy to see them there, their assignment is to ask questions and to interact with the speakers. We tell speakers not to spend their full time giving their presentation, to spend no more than a third to a half of the time giving their presentation so there can truly be a dialogue. So we take very seriously this idea of information sharing. And I think you mentioned the need for communication, and I would suggest to you that it's probably more important today than it's ever been, given constrained budgets, especially if we find ourselves back in sequestration, which could happen in 2016. And that means that government's got to get it right the first time. You know, we can't afford to have failed programs. We can't afford to duplicate programs. And so that means government needs to talk to each other, and they need to talk to industry. And we provide at least one way to do that. Obviously, there are other needs, but GAO every year.
Hold the GAO thought. We're going to take a break. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Back after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest is Kent Schneider, and I rudely interrupted him at the end of the last segment. So, Kent, if you would, just pick it up where you left off.
Well, so we were talking about the need for communication, and I was making the case that it's more important today than ever, partly because of budget constraints and needing to get it right. But also, I mentioned that GAO periodically does a study of IT acquisition and management. And if you go back over the last three or four reports, you'll find a great deal of consistency where they have carefully documented billions of dollars of waste every year. Now, there are a number of reasons for that, but a lot of it comes down to lack of effective communication within government, which results in duplication and programs that don't interact well with each other, and then communication between government and industry. Pushing against that are the new set of policies that we've seen, partly driven by the budget and sequestration, partly driven by the reaction to the GSA debacle that you'll recall, a GSA conference that was held in Las Vegas. There was clearly some bad judgment applied in that conference, but there was just a huge reaction to that in terms of new controls on travel, new controls on conferences, and it has made it more difficult to do effective conferences. We at FCEA have learned over the last year and a half and have had to change a bit the way we operate. Clearly today you need more focus. I mentioned earlier the engagement with government and industry, but now the policy in government is that you must focus on mission-critical issues. You must focus on training, and particularly certification training. Fortunately, that's right in our lane, so that works well. You must hold conferences in places where there's a significant local audience to minimize travel requirements, which says that there's no place that's inherently bad to hold a conference, but based on the subject of the conference and the target audience, you need to locate it where there's a significant local audience that's interested in that particular topic. So we have adjusted our program to do that. We tend to be more focused today. We're particularly attentive to mission criticality of the topics and the issues that we take on. And we have put a lot more emphasis on training. So at every one of our conferences now, you will see training identified on the program. You will see every session indicating whether it carries continuing education units, which is important. So people who already have certifications, in order to maintain those, have to have a certain number of continuing education units every year. If we can supply that as part of our events without any additional cost, that's a great value to both government and industry. The other thing we've done is that we no longer charge government for anything connected to our events. So we don't charge them registration. We don't charge them at all. So their only cost is the cost of whoever has to travel, which makes it easy for them to predict what the cost will be and to get as many people there as possible. So now that training becomes essentially free to government, with only travel costs to consider. So it's a different environment than it was before. We are seeing the audience begin to bounce back, right after GSA and the new policies were put in place, and especially after sequestration was implemented in FY13, we saw a significant drop off in attendance, particularly government attendance. That's now coming back. I won't suggest to you that it's back where it was before, but it's certainly better than it was in 2013, and I believe that it will continue to get better as we go forward. Not so much because there's more money, but because now people understand the policies better. They understand what they can approve, what they can't, what they can do, what they can't, and that's allowing them to make better decisions.
Well, that first, I guess, 90 minutes to 9 months or so, there was just a tremendous number of cancellation of government-sponsored events that were really designed around professional training, the Green Government Conference, a whole slew of them. But it was a reaction to the situation. So once the seas calmed down a bit, people looked at it a little more rationally and understood that some events are obviously better than others, but no events is not good.
Yeah, we were actually pretty fortunate at FCEA. Some other organizations had to cancel quite a number of events due to either the new policies or the budget situation. We only had to cancel one event, and we had to retime 5 events. But our support has generally held up pretty well.
I'd say, batting average-wise, you came out way ahead of a lot of folks. Rather than get started on the C4ISR topic, let's pick that up after the break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is Kent Schneider, President and CEO of FCEA. Back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is Kent Schneider, who is the President and CEO of FCEA. You can find lots of information about FCEA at afcea.org. I suggest you do so. If you're listening to this, you are probably in, regardless of whether you're listening in D.C. or on the web, you're probably in the vicinity of an FCEA chapter. I would strongly suggest, if you are either a government employee or a contractor selling to the government, look into your local chapter of FCEA. Ken, I know your primary focus and from your first days as a lieutenant, that C4ISR has been kind of a moving target all along. What's FCEA's involvement here? What are the key issues?
Well, C4ISR, command and control, communications, IT, and then the whole intelligence community involvement and integration with all of that is really center lane for FCEA. That's really kind of the core of what we work on. And technology is turning over so fast today. It is at the same time enabling more capability across the C4ISR space, but at the same time offering a number of challenges with regard to interoperability, the development of the workforce, the retraining requirements, and it gets even more profound as information sharing is broader. So in today's environment, certainly no military service operates by itself, but the defense community doesn't operate by itself anymore either. The boundary between defense and security has narrowed. So now civil agencies, including the 22 agencies in the Department of Homeland Security, but others as well, are involved in the process. And then the United States seldom either goes to war or participates in disaster relief or humanitarian assistance by itself. We operate as part of a coalition in most cases, and that makes C4ISR even more challenging. It's also been more complicated recently by the growth of the cybersecurity threat. And so we not only have to provide the capability to command and control our forces to gather intelligence, but we now also have to protect those resources from cyber attack, and that's getting to be a more significant threat every day. So there just is a huge amount of migration of technology to allow us to do that. And of course, you know most of the major areas of concern. Big data and analytics is part of that. Big data is really about how you handle large volumes of information, but convert those fairly rapidly to knowledge, because just having a bunch of information that's disconnected is not particularly useful. In that same vein, cloud technologies are becoming very important. Cloud technologies are a use of virtualization across systems so that you're no longer bound by a single device or a single application, because it's now spread across multiple devices. It can be geographically dispersed. That makes it easier to share information, and it makes it easier to secure, because you don't have the boundaries that stand in the way of situational awareness and being able to see what's going on. Mobility is becoming key. We're constantly on the move now. Historically, IT systems were fairly anchored, and we used radios when we were mobile. Primarily voice. Now we have the ability to operate on a mobile basis using voice, video, data, and using a variety of mobile devices. The government is just really coming to grips with how to effectively use the explosion in the commercial market of mobile devices, and part and parcel of that is security. And so they're trying to figure out, how do you leverage these commercial devices but still maintain security? So that's a huge effort. Identity management is a big deal. Identity management is the idea of establishing trust remotely. This is very important when you're sharing information across enterprises. And as I said, now we're getting into joint interagency and coalition information sharing. So identifying the person that wants access to your information or that you're communicating with becomes much more difficult. And so a lot of effort being applied now to what's called federated identity management systems, the ability to operate across multiple enterprises. So there's just a huge amount of new technology being applied in new ways, but all with the same objective, which is to enhance information sharing and at the same time provide security for the information and the infrastructure.
Okay. I'm glad I'm not responsible for the security side of everything, because that's just one scary beast, the IT security end. AFSCME has been a leader in terms of content generation, not simply through your events, but through Signal Magazine, the discussions that I've been a part of or attended at various AFSCME events. Talk a little bit about this, because content content has a new life of its own for marketers. Content is king, but a lot of the content out there is fluff, and I don't think you guys produce that.
No, we focus within our mission area, but we do develop a lot of content that has a lot of forms. And increasingly, people are very interested in the thread of a subject, looking at something in terms of a campaign as opposed to kind of separate events. And so we're leveraging all of our media. Of course, we have Signal Magazine, which is our monthly magazine. It's available in print. It's also available in a digital version on our website. It's also available through apps on both iOS, the Apple devices, and Android devices. We have a variety of online media that are available and can be customized to particular missions and to provide content distribution. We even have a radio show that we do right here on Federal News Radio biweekly, late drive time on Fridays. And in fact, Max Kakis, who you mentioned, is the moderator for that radio show.
Captive audience, too. Late Friday, there's not going to be any traffic.
You know? Right. What else? And what else are you going to listen to, right? So, yeah. So we do. We're trying to use as broad a set of media as possible, and we're constantly surveying our membership to find out how they want to consume content. And it wouldn't surprise you that the younger members consume it very differently than our older members. I mean, to them, everything's digital, everything's mobile. It's all about immersion. They want multimedia. And so we've had to change over time. And as you know, the entire media community is changing, whether commercial or business to business. But we're trying to stay ahead of that. And fortunately, we've done pretty well so far. Signal Magazine continues to be an award-winning magazine and is often rated as the largest benefit by many of our members.
It's good pub. You are also early adopter for some of the social media out there, particularly Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, we have a particularly strong presence on LinkedIn. We have a private group with 5,200 members. We have a public group that's got over 2,000 followers, and then. We have other groups tied to regional and chapter officers, young AFCEANs, women in AFCEA. We're on Twitter with over 2,500 followers. We're on Facebook with 3,500 or so people following us. So we're always trying to find ways to get information out. And the nice part about the social media is that we can use it to expand the reach of our events as well. So we're tweeting, I'm a digital immigrant at best. And interestingly, I just got back from a 2-week trip to Europe, including an event that we did with NATO. And for the first time ever, I personally tweeted from an event. I'm not sure how well I did, but I got to understand exactly how limited that that small number of
that keyboard is a pain in the butt too.
Well, it is, but it's important that we get the information out to an audience broader than what can attend the events.
Right, I've noticed the activity on LinkedIn. I'm less active, much less active, almost non-active on Facebook. I do have a Twitter account. I use it to push, but on LinkedIn, I monitor a number of the AFCEA groups, and most of them tend to be among the more active and better managed, because not all groups are created equal on LinkedIn. I want to thank you very much for coming in today. Greatly appreciated. Any final thoughts?
No, I appreciate the invitation to come down and talk to you today. We're always looking for ways to get better understanding of AFCEA, what we do, and support for the community. And this is an opportunity to do that. So thanks for the invitation.
Great. Well, you'll be back. You've been listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is not my day job. I advise companies on all aspects of marketing to the government, and I advise a lot of companies and individuals on leveraging LinkedIn. But thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.